This is the first taped interview with Ray Middleton in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 29th of the 7th, 1999, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ray, I thought that we could begin by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please.
Raymond Stewart Middleton, born in Perth, 1917.
And who are your parents?
Parents were Edward Isaac Stewart Middleton and Violet Amelia Middleton. Edward had been born in Victoria, came over with his family for the gold rush. Violet was the son of James Britton, Bert Britton, and granddaughter of James Britton, one of the pioneers of Perth. So we're a long-established West Australian family.
And what about brothers and sisters?
Well, I was the third of five brothers, no sisters, but innumerable cousins, almost all girls, because my mother's family was very large, with, I think, nine girls and two boys. Father, on the other hand, had only small family, most of them in the eastern states.
Could you name your brothers?
Yes. Len, 5 years older. Alan, 2 years older. Max, 5 years younger. And then Wally, who was 6 years younger again. So there was a big spread of the family.
What was your father's occupation?
He was a clerk. He self-taught as an accountant and secretary, and he finished up as a company secretary. But he always had difficulties in that employment was irregular. He had taught himself shorthand. I still have his book where he taught himself shorthand in 1908. And he was extraordinarily good at that. But he was never an assertive person, and so he had some difficulties with employment, and we were victims of the Depression.
Could you tell us a few of your strongest memories as a child?
Yes, we were mobile. I think this is where employment came into it. So I was born in Victoria Park, and I have memories of houses, presumably we were renting, in Victoria Park and in Mount Hawthorn briefly, and Inglewood, where we bought. And we're still there, and fortunately the moratorium applied, or we would have lost the house because of the Depression, when there was no one in the family employed for a period. So we spent, I think, the biggest part of my youth in Inglewood, 10th Avenue. And that was very convenient because my family were very keen on education and insisted that we all aim for Perth Modern School, and the three eldest all went there, including me, of course. And in order to do so, there were only two schools that were considered good in the 20s, and that was either North Perth or Highgate. So we travelled from Victoria Park originally, and then after we'd moved from Inglewood, two trams if need be to go to Highgate School, and sure enough, the Len got a scholarship and Alan and I each got entrances in the days when Modern School was the only state school which allowed further higher education. So we were each able to stay on at least to junior. Finances never permitted anyone to go on to fifth year, which in any case was reserved to the top 100 in those days who could go to university. And we knew we had no financial prospects, and that only occurred, we only made the opportunity after the war.
What were some of your aspirations as a young chap?
Very limited, and the hobbies in those days were limited. The army was the only hobby that one could afford in the Depression, and that and swimming. And so I did a lot of surfing. We had a an aunt's beach cottage at Scarborough, which we used to visit, and we managed to buy a block for £5 and build a beach cottage for £50 in Scarborough in just before the Depression. And this we used to go to whenever we could. So surfing was obviously the hobby, but I was in the cadets from the age of 16 and the militia as soon as I was old enough, right through till I enlisted in the AIF. And that was a hobby, and I found recently the evidence where I held a rifleman's marksman's badge and a machine gunner's badge and a rangefinder's badge, you know, all the things that the army gave. Apparently I got £5 a year for those or something, but that was minor. I thought it was my hobby.
So what did being involved with the cadets and the militia involve?
Attendance at least fortnightly, and until we reached the age of 18, it was unpaid attendance at the drill hall in the centre of Perth, the old original drill hall, I can't think of the name at the moment, and it's now in the reserved archive type thing, Swan Barracks, where we went through very archaic drills, 1914-18 stuff, using 1914-18 rifles. We would learn the parts of rifles and Lewis guns, Vickers guns, and whatever other equipment they had, and annual camps, provided your employer would release you. After I was able to join the public service, then I could get annual leave, so we had camps, which we enjoyed in first one at York, and then I think I was in the party that first started the Northern Camp in the early 30s. We actually had to clear the bush enough to erect tents in order to carry out a week's camp at Northam site. And one of the incidents that springs to mind is that on the very first night we bedded down at dark, and we didn't have to have a reveille in the morning because there was an almighty scream of pain where the regimental quartermaster sergeant's tent had been pitched over a bull ant nest. And came dawn, came the bull ants, came the alarm. So that was a very effective reveille.
So we're talking about the 30s and the mid-30s.
30s, that's right.
And you were working in the public service. What was your job?
The job in those days, the one ambition of my father is get yourself somewhere where there is security, get in the public service. I was lucky, although I left school in 1932, then I was the only member of the family who was able to get work without any battle. And the first job I got was 7 and 6 pence a week, looking after a small manufacturer's agent's office, only 44 hours a week, have your own bike, deliver as required, and mind the place as required, and do everything else required. I was only there a fortnight when I was offered a job for 10 and 6 pence a week, which might have been permanent. So we moved to that job and found that I had a 48-hour week, use my own bike, deliver every letter around town to save postage, and pick up all the mail for the business on the way, and after work, deliver all the mail for postage. In the meantime, fill all inkwells and work all day, carting out everything from the strong room in the morning, take it all back at night. I was only there 3 weeks. I presumably was to be a trainee clerk, which in that case was starting from as low a level as one could get. And then application for public service was accepted, and I was supposed to go in as a junior clerk. I think in those days they called you a messenger until you turn, say, 16 or 17, then a trainee junior clerk, then your junior clerk, and then if you've passed enough exams you might become permanent, and then if you passed the next exam you became a clerk. And it was a very rigid system based on the English model. And you had a G exam, which I was exempt from because I had a junior in nine subject in this case. And at the age of between 20 and 22, you'd have to pass the F exam with five specified subjects at certain levels, and only if you passed that were you eligible to be called a clerk. And then after that, promotion came on, applying for positions as gazetted in the public service thereafter. A very rigid authoritarian system, permanency involved all the way. And that would have lasted forever, but I had other ideas, and the war intervened anyway.
Well, the war did come about, but the Depression had been pretty rife
at
that time. How had it affected your life, and what was it like to live in Perth?
Depression was absolute in Perth. 30% of, so as I, the figures that I've been given, 30% of all males were unemployed. Since no females worked in those days virtually, then that meant 30% of all family heads were unemployed. And the dole was very limited, 15 shillings a week for the breadwinner. And I think something like, I couldn't the exact figure, about 6 shillings a week for dependents. And they even specified the foods you were allowed to buy with the dole money. For example, you were only allowed to buy Australian-made raisins, and they specified the type of foodstuff. I think Vitabrits was allowed, but they recommended instead that you would get what are the ingredients of porridge, Australian-made, of course. And therefore, they did encourage Australian industry, but it was necessary because it was a heavy impost. There was a financial institution's duty in those days was a 22% reduction in pay in all employees throughout the country. And when my first job in the public service, they said, your job is on 15 shillings a week, less 22%. And so on, until that was repealed about 1936. This was used to finance the people on the dole, because that would have been out of 250,000 or some such figure in WA, it would have meant then 60,000 families being supported by the others. In the country, they were living on rabbits and boiled wheat, and people were working for the dole, as was required. I knew a number of people who, because they were single, they were required to work 6 weeks at a time building the road between Margaret River and Augusta. And they did that by cutting down the trees by hand, by horses and scoops, and then filling it with gravel and pounding down. I saw Stirling Highway being built, with men individually breaking great lumps of gravel with a hammer in order to widen Stirling Highway somewhere in the 30s. There were no bulldozers. I didn't see one in Western Australia until 1945. So horse scoops were the norm, and labour then was very manual and very manpower heavy.
So tell us what the effects of the coming of the war had on?
Jobs became plentiful for the first time. There was an alternative. For example, gold was down to a minimal figure. It looked as if I was going to be sent, this is perhaps a byline, when jobs in the gold fields were so scarce that we had the virtually a civil war in Kalgoorlie, when the miners attacked the Italians and Slavs who accepted the lower rates of pay, and it looked as though they were going to send us in the militia up. And I remember my father saying, no way will you shoot Australians for dagos. So anyway, the question didn't arise. The government enlisted 1,000 special policemen and sent them to Kalgoorlie and settled it. But that's how much jobs were valued, and there was a lot of xenophobia. They disliked the invasion of anyone that might take their jobs. Foreigners were not very welcome. POMs were not seen as foreigners, and the experiments on the group settlements, although terrible failures at terrible cost in lives, were effective only in the next generation. and I know a number of people, including my brother-in-law as one, and a number of people in the unit likewise, that I met later. But they were the costs. Food was always a problem. Backyard, those who could grow backyard vegetables were in a big advantage. And food was cheap. I know that we used to buy our meat when we could for threepence a pound. Was quite normal, obviously, the sort of scrag end of mutton type thing. This is a way of eking out. And many things that would now be never acceptable were perfectly reasonable at that time.
So with the coming of the war and the changing of the situation in Europe, what was the effect that it had on society and young men like yourselves?
I would say that there would be about, I'd have to guess the percentage, a very large percentage of early enlistments were driven by the need for jobs as much as they were by any other ideas. I have a figure given on fair authority from a mate who was in the Pay Corps from an early enlistment. Of the first 1,000 enlisted in Western Australia, he said that 40% of them were keeping two families, and the reason for enlistment was that the army was the only authority who paid both families. Wife and de factos were paid only in the forces. That's the only way they could cope. One of my own section told me he enlisted because he got a £40 tax bill. And that was subsequently written off for all those who enlisted. And I know I ground my teeth because I'd paid my tax bill before I enlisted.
Were you keen to go?
Oh, yes. I saw it as a follow-up from my training. I had been an intelligence sergeant in the 11th Battalion prior to the war, and so I was quite anxious to go. My family said, "Don't be so damn silly. World War One proved what a waste it was. Who wants to waste their lives in the trenches?" And we'd lost a lot of uncles and whatever. And my own father had been restrained with great difficulty from enlisting because he had five sons under age at that point. And that would have been a battle, I gather, from family comments. So they said, my mother said, "I'm not going to stop anyone again. I fought hard for years to stop your father. But so I won't give you my blessing, but I can't stop you."
What about your brothers?
Well, I was the first to go in, straight from the militia, the moment the invasion of France was announced. I was studying for my accountancy and I'd passed my F exam, so I was already on the promotion list type of thing. But I refrained from going. I said, "No, the war's not on really, there's nothing doing in France." But the moment the fall of France appeared imminent and the invasion there, I went straight in and enlisted. And then found a week later there was my application to go and get examined for my commission, which of course I missed because I had to revert to the ranks. But that was my reaction. Both my brothers, one was in the bank up in Dalwallinu and the other was travelling with good Durrant and Murray's down in Katanning. They both went and applied for the Air Force and both were accepted and both lost their lives as a result. The next younger brother, who was less academically interested at that point, he managed to talk my father into signing his papers to sign on for 12 years with the Navy in April 39. So we got a postcard in October to say, "Dear Mum and Dad, we are at sea." And I know my mother was furious. "Why are they sending a 16-year-old boy at sea?" She wrote a letter to the Minister for the Navy. And he delayed waiting until another 4 months. And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry about that, but he's turned 17 now, he's eligible." In the meantime, he'd fought in the Battle of Matapan and a couple of others. So we had four of the five in active service, and the other one was far too young, and they sat on him, and no way would they sign any papers, even in 1945 when he was busting a boiler to go. And he's still resenting the fact that he was not able to enlist.
What sort of propaganda were you subject to?
Not much propaganda at all. Very little was needed. After all, there's a chance you could get a good suit of clothes, you could get a living wage. We were a bit resentful when Bob Menzies announced that you were going to be 5 bob a day, and then he reluctantly said 6 bob a day. It had been 5 bob in World War One. We thought surely the cost of living has risen a little bit since 1914, and so he made us the 6 bob a day passengers, and that was the jokes used in the press. And then, of course, there was an extra shilling, oh, that's right, 9 shillings for a corporal and 10 shillings for a sergeant and so on. And since that was a 7-day week and all found, it was pretty good pay compared with the jobs which were not available.
Do you recall Menzies announcing that Australia was at war?
Oh, yes. On September the 3rd, we all listened to the radio and heard that announcement. And we'd heard the Neville Chamberlain. And the night before, it was all on the radio. I know I immediately got up to the family and said, right, I must go and see a girl I was fairly serious with. I got on the bike, rode 2 miles down to her place and said, it's all off till after the war, I'll be enlisting. And she said, if that's the way you feel, get out. So I did.
Tell us about joining up.
I went down to the drill hall in Nicholson Road, Subiaco, and we just sat around and waited until they called us in batches. I think we played 2 up or something while we waited. And we didn't do the American system of queuing up and swearing. I gather we signed a declaration. I'd completely forgotten how we did it, but I saw a case the other day which reminded me we obviously signed a form. And I swear to do my duty, etc., etc., until the duration of the war and up to 1 year thereafter. And when we signed that, that was subject to a medical exam, which was where we were prodded and probed and stripped and so on, and then passed A1 or A2, as the case might be. And I remember we had to step on some white powder and then step on the floor, and if you're footprint was totally clear, then you were flat-footed and you were out. But if you had an arch showing, then you were okay and you were able to march for infantry. I think some of the flat-footed ones might have been acceptable for drivers, but they weren't testing at that point. And it was a pretty routine type. Those that were accepted, which was 99%, were then given a travel warrant to report to whatever camp. They were doing a series of different places, and I think I was sent to Northam and my travel warrant, and I was told, if you're in the militia, you've got a uniform, wear that up there, which I did. And when I got up there, they eyed it with suspicion, militia uniform, hand that in, and here's your giggle suit, the khaki drills and so on.
Why were they called giggle suits?
Well, I think to look at one was enough to make one giggle. I can't think of any other good reason. He looked a fright. And remember, we all had our photo taken with a height measurement alongside us, and we were weighed, and a description, and we put in our paybook, and we all looked like as though we were entering Fremantle Prison at the time.
How long did you think that you would be serving for?
I expected a couple of years myself. I had no idea that a war would be over by Christmas, not when the way France was going. I had no expectations of a quick war, but I certainly didn't expect it to be 5 or 6 years.
What did you actually think that you would be fighting for?
I thought we'd be fighting for preserving the Western way of life. Hitler certainly had been given the press has a monster who invaded successively the Rhineland, Czechoslovakia after he'd promised peace, and then Poland using excuses. And once he started on France and then went through neutral Holland and Belgium, then he said, well, he's not going to stop. He will have to be stopped. And Australia was still seen as part very much of the British Empire.
You were to become a corporal. Tell us about that.
While I was in Northam, we had the original part of the 2nd 16th Battalion, and we were just put in doing training, drill and all the other things with a pretty harsh regime. Northam in winter with a reveille at 5 o'clock and an emu stalk, that means go around with bayonets, pick over a piece of paper for a half an hour, followed by a cup of black coffee, followed by drill, followed by breakfast, followed by drill all day. And sleeping in the tent, the huts which had been built, totally unlined, and given 3 blankets, I think, and in winter that northern that's needed. So it was a pretty tough training period. Very little had got to the stage, for example, of even firing practice, but they sent a number of us down to Guildford Command Training School on the banks of the Helena River. There was an area just upstream from Guildford where they conducted courses, and these were intensive courses. And according to one's results, say you were promoted instantly or recommended for it. One or two got straight sergeant. One or two got recommended to do a course for officers in due course, and in my case, an immediate corporal. Then we were sent back to our unit. In the meantime, I found that the job I wanted, intelligence sergeant, was what I had been with the 11th, had been filled, because the officer concerned had managed to get 3 sergeants from 3 battalions to go in as privates. So he said, well, I want somebody who is excellent with a camera and excellent at field sketching. And I said, well, neither. I couldn't afford a camera. And field sketching was never my strength. So he said, right, you're out. I said, thank you. How nice. So I immediately wrote in application to join the newly formed 2nd 28th, just forming at Melville Camp down here in the Pine Plantation. I'd been in camp for 3 months training there in the Melville with the 11th. They did a continuous camp from September to December, compulsory training for all those already in the militia. So it was familiar territory, and I had heard that they were forming the 2nd 28th. I said, whoopee, they will want intelligence sergeant there. I put in, nothing happened. So I did nothing until out of the blue a month later, Corporal Middleton, here's your warrant, report to Melville Camp tomorrow. They're out of the blue, so I'd completely forgotten about this. Anyway, I went down there and was interviewed, and they said, well, our intelligence is filled, but we do want a corporal in 5th Platoon. Will you accept it? I said, oh yeah, okay. So I did. All my service then, active service, was with the 2nd 28th Battalion. From there on, that was it.
So tell us about actually departing.
We formed as this battalion in Melville. Within a month, they moved it to Northam. In the meantime, the 2nd 16th had gone overseas. So we moved up to back to Northam, where I'd already been, different batch of huts. There were many more had been built. And we went through the routine of training. Most of it is wasted effort, trying to get people to march in step, to do ordinary rifle drill, and a little bit only of practical work like actual firing and making sure you can shoot. That had never been my trouble anyway, and possibly they were aware of that. And I remember I even had a lesson in how to drive a truck with the transport section. And we did various things then until the end of November, when we were sent on pre-embarkation leave for a couple of weeks. We were allowed occasional weekend leaves during the time of training, and then told to stand by.